This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Today's media landscape is one marked by continuous change thanks to the increasing relevance of citizen journalism, homemade content creation, and social media's prominence in mainstream media. Audiences no longer have to wait for a newspaper to be published or sit by the TV or radio for the evening news to get caught up on the happenings around town or across the country. That plays a significant role in how people consume or whether they trust the media in front of them. And nearly 10 years ago, video of Eric Garner being held in a lethal chokehold by New York City police and footage of protests that followed the fatal shooting of Michael Brown Jr. in Ferguson by police demonstrated how various mediums on different platforms drive culture, politics, and our relationship with news media. Eric Deggans is NPR's TV critic and media analyst, and he joins us today to share his thoughts on the matter. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, Eric, in December of 2014, you wrote the first of your now annual summaries of important moments in media, and that happened to also be your first year in review for NPR. First of all, why is it that you chose the term media moments?
Well, what I was trying to do was look back and capture things that had happened in media that were not planned, that were viral moments that captured people's attention in unexpected ways and in really pivotal ways. And there was a sense back then that the response to the shooting of Michael Brown and the protests that followed was changing media and was changing society in ways that maybe we were only beginning to understand even at the end of that year. Mm-hmm. So it landed at the top of my list that year.
Yeah. And where were you, Eric, when all of that was going on? Like, where in the country, and what is it that you were hearing around you?
Well, I live in St. Petersburg, Florida, right next to Tampa, in the Tampa Bay area on the west side of Florida. So, what was happening where I was? I mean, of course, we were glued to the TV sets while the protests were happening, trying to get a sense of what was happening. And I even had some friends who were involved in covering what was going on there. So I was even concerned for my friends' safety. But it also reminded me of Trayvon Martin, who was a young, unarmed black teen who was killed by a, self-appointed neighborhood watch person, George Zimmerman, in 2012. And that happened in Florida. That happened probably like a 2-hour drive from where I live. And so the parallels between this idea of, a young black man who was killed under circumstances that were tough to discern, allegations of police misconduct, and then protests that arose as a way to pressure the system into acting. All of that kind of reminded me of Trayvon Martin, although the cycle where we went from Michael Brown's death to protests and public pressure was much quicker. And that was the thing. There's almost a through line that connects Trayvon Martin's death and connects Michael Brown's death and connects George Floyd's death, in that the process where you go from the actual death to widespread media coverage and protests and public pressure just gets faster and faster and faster. And so we saw attention on what happened to Michael Brown, instantly catch fire in media, and protests soon followed.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your 2014 sort of year in review, the title or a subtitle, Media Moments That Changed Us in 2014 is what we see. What exactly was the change that you were referring to, Eric?
Part of it was us getting more used to viral videos that would communicate concern about these, that would communicate details about these incidents and concern about these details. Mm-hmm. Again, to sort of draw a loose analogy, you know, when Trayvon Martin was killed in 2012, you know, there was some audio recording of what happened because some people had called 911 and those calls were recorded, but there wasn't any video. And it took a long time to call the public's attention to what had happened there and to create the public pressure that eventually led to police charging George Zimmerman with a crime. In the case of Michael Brown, although his conflict with the police officer who shot and killed him was not caught on any kind of video, there was a lot of press coverage, you know, that sort of captured the scene after his death and the attempt to capture evidence and people gathering to sort of figure out what was going on and his body lying in the street and all of this stuff. And all of that became viral videos that informed people about what was happening and kind of mobilized them quicker than what happened with Trayvon Martin. And then, of course, we get to George Floyd, where his actual death is captured on viral video. So we're getting to, not only are we as a society becoming more used to the idea that viral videos will give us crucial information in the moment about these situations that may involve police brutality or police overstepping, we also are people who are in these situations realize, oh, I better pull out my phone and capture this. Because who knows what's going to happen. And the reason why, you know, we had video of George Floyd is because somebody who was there watching the police, you know, hold him down said, I better film this. And they filmed it. And then they released it outside of any sort of official, you know, apparatus, outside of the media, outside of law enforcement. So in a terrible way, it, you know, what happened to Michael Brown kind of prepared us for this moment where people feel like they have to document what's going on just in case something terrible is happening, even if they don't necessarily know, because we're used now to seeing these videos recorded in the moment that capture much more than, you know, any sort of official journalist might be able to capture.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as the term media goes, I mean, one of the things as we here on the team, we're thinking about how do we have this conversation is the way that we understand what media meant then in 2014 and how it has evolved to what it is now. How would you describe, Eric, what does media mean today?
Well, I just think, I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, media hasn't necessarily changed like a tremendous amount other than the influence of social media and online platforms has just grown and grown and become more fractured and more diverse. So, you know, back when Michael Brown was killed, you know, you might say that Twitter, which is now called X, is a social media platform where a lot of people got used to turning to that for news, to find out about news, to something is happening, a bunch of people are covering it. You go onto Twitter to use social media to figure out what everybody's reporting, along with all the videos that people, you know, civilians, you know, average people might be posting. And in a way you can sort of really get a pastiche, get an overview of everything that's being talked about. Well, now, you know, TikTok is a much bigger has a much bigger impact. YouTube has grown. These other social media platforms have grown, and because of you know, X and Twitter's, you know, sort of convolutions to try and reinvent itself after Elon Musk bought it, you know, its influence has waned, and a lot of news outlets, including NPR, don't actively post there officially anymore. Mm-hmm. And so you have to go to other platforms to maybe monitor what they're doing and bring that together with what average people are doing. So TikTok might be a place where you would look now, where you wouldn't have looked back when Michael Brown was killed. Or YouTube might be a place where you would look now, because many more people are used to recording video podcasts and putting up found footage on YouTube in a way that maybe they weren't quite as used to doing back when Michael Brown was killed. So in a way, media is the same, but it has grown. It has gotten more specific. It is fractured. The audience has fractured. And some places that we were used to turning to find news, particularly Facebook and X, Twitter, have maybe reduced in importance, while other ones have grown.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to go back to that subtitle for what you wrote in 2014, and it was, you know, again, media moments that changed us in 2014. So, I mean, who was the us that you were talking about at that time, and is it the same now?
Well, I mean, in a way, I was trying to get anyone who might read this story to consider how they might have been changed by mm-hmm. what happened. Mm-hmm. So I was casting a wide net with that headline. But the idea is that, you know, the story of what happened there and the way in which it spread across media, particularly social media, had influences on a wide range of people, depending on who you are, where you heard about it, how you feel about issues of police brutality and marginalization of people of color, mm-hmm. and even protesting, you know, civil protest, mm-hmm. and so there was that whole incident became something that was talked about for quite a long while, and people on many different areas of the political spectrum were using what happened there to prove their point of view, whether it was people who were trying to make the point about how deadly police brutality could be to people of color, or it was people trying to make the point that sometimes these confrontations with police officers are exaggerated by people who want to criticize the police, mm-hmm. and that, you know, I mean, ultimately, you know, prosecutors determined that they could not charge this officer with a crime in the death of Michael Brown. So you had people from a range of political and social perspectives citing what happened there and looking at what was on media and commenting on footage provided and talking about even law enforcement's media strategy. Mm-hmm. You know, why did they release video of him in this convenience store, of Michael Brown in this convenience store, you know, before he was killed? Why, when they were protests and there were reporters trying to cover what was going on, why did some of them get arrested by police officers, even though it was obvious that they were journalists? Right. You know, there was a lot of different things that were kind of hitting, that were being spread on social media, but also where media was involved, mm-hmm. and so it became this giant trending topic that revealed a lot about where we were as a society, and revealed a lot about where media was, and revealed a lot about what urban policing was, and, you know, even inspired, you know, a close analysis by the Department of Justice that, you know, that found that the police officers in Ferguson were systematically oppressing Black people there. So, right. You know,
it's a great spot, I think. We're going to take a very quick break, and we're going to pick up with that when we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. Welcome back. Let's return to our conversation with Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic and media analyst. We're talking about the way media moments in 2014, particularly video of Eric Garner and protests after the police killing of Mike Brown Jr., impacted media as we knew it then and continues to have effects through today. Now, Eric, before the break, you were talking about the way in which some people's stories or accounts are dismissed or assumed to be exaggerated. And much of the time, these are stories that pertain to people of color, very often with Black Americans. And I don't think it's any accident that the two moments that we've talked about involve Black victims. Now, recently, you tweeted, Eric, about a new Pew report about Black Americans' mistrust, that is, of media. And that report talks about news media as well as TV shows and films. And they had an interesting choice of words for something that's currently under review. And that was, quote, racial conspiracy theories. Do you think enough people, Eric, are taking these criticisms of media seriously? And, you know, are people still not being believed in the way that they should be, even with this preponderance of footage and evidence that is shared online by everyday citizens?
Well, you know, there's a whole lot in that in the answer to that question that you ask. First, I'll point out that in terms of the Pew study that you talked about, they have already changed how it is worded. Mm-hmm. When it was first released, they called Black people's suspicions about how news media treats them racial conspiracy theories. And, you know, in even though if you might look at the strict definition of the term conspiracy theory, you might say that that includes ideas about conspiracies against you that might be true. We have come to use that term conspiracy theory in modern parlance to refer to things that are imagined conspiracies that are probably not true. Mm-hmm. So the wording in the study seemed to transmit this idea that Black people's suspicion about how the news media treats them might be a conspiracy theory. It might be untrue or not based in fact or exaggerated. And, you know, we're at a situation where there are large numbers of newspapers that have officially apologized for how they covered the civil rights movement in the 60s and the 70s, saying that they marginalized Black voices, that they unfairly characterized civil rights leaders and their goals in the movement, and unfairly supported white people who were hostile to the interests of integration and ending segregation and all of it. So, there's some very real, tangible, you know, evidence that Black people's feeling about how the news media treats them is grounded in fact and persists even to this day. All of that said, we are also in a situation where people of color and people who are marginalized are constantly challenged to prove that marginalization and prove the damaging impact of the systems that they know are hurting them in society. Mm-hmm. And as we enter into a media world where, like I said, increasingly people are whipping out their phones and recording things immediately when they happen, it also creates this dynamic where people get suspicious about whether something happened if you don't have video of it,
right,
particularly
right.
Something, you know, major, where a lot of people might be around and there would have been a lot of opportunity to record it. So we enter into this moment where people of color are increasingly expected to prove their marginalization and oppression and harm. And that fuels the tendency to pull out a phone when someone, in power seems to be treating you badly. Mm-hmm. Now, on top of all of this, the Michael Brown situation is particularly difficult because, you have to admit that it is entirely possible that what the police officer said about how, I mean, as far as I know, I haven't delved into this issue in depth, you know, recently. But my understanding of all the investigations that sprouted from Michael Brown's death is that, you know, it is possible to say that the police officer's account of what happened is true, that he had gotten an emergency call saying that a local convenience store had something had been stolen from it. He comes across these two guys. He speaks to them. Michael Brown says something harsh to him. He stops. And then he says Michael Brown reaches into his car and attacks him. The person who was Michael Brown's companion said that the officer attacked Michael Brown first. And then the officer said that Michael Brown charged him after a short chase and he had to shoot him because he was in fear of his life. And what we do know is that there wasn't enough evidence to contradict that story for him, for the officer to be charged with the crime. Mm-hmm. So it's a highly ambiguous situation. But what it did was it drew attention to how law enforcement operated in Ferguson, and that unearthed data that proved that people of color in Ferguson were treated unfairly by police officers because the Department of Justice did a lengthy investigation. So you have a situation where there's an ambiguous confrontation with a police officer, but it happens in a town where most of the people who live there know that the police are treating black people and people of color differently. Mm-hmm. So, the Michael Brown situation is incredibly complex. And I think that's one reason why George Floyd's murder had an even greater impact because it was so clear cut in a way.
Right.
You know, the video wasn't edited. The video that the civilian recorded wasn't edited. People could watch what happened over more than 8 minutes. And it was a situation where they could see how the police officers reacted and see how it resulted in George Floyd's death, which was something that we didn't have in Michael Brown's case.
Right. But the extent to which now there's an expectation for video is, I think, something insofar as the question I had asked earlier about who the us is and what the change has been, that is all part of it. We also talked earlier, Eric, about how we as the audience or as content creators or journalists are more used to taking out our phones and recording moments, whether that be audio or visual content, and then sharing it widely on social media platforms like X or Instagram. What is there to say about how audiences engage with media and how we all consume and interact with it?
Well, I think in the case of Michael Brown's death, what we learned, and we already kind of knew this, but we really learned it in the wake of his death and in the wake of other people of color who died in similar situations where people tried to record video, is that, you know, we are, you know, our phones and the cameras inside them are turning us all into potential journalists, all into potential media outlets, all into potential witnesses. And when something is happening where you are concerned that there may be an injustice, or you're concerned that something, that an emergency is going down, or you just want to document what's happening, you know, the reflex to pull out that phone and record it, and as an aside, the recording technology has gotten better and better and better. The phones now record a much clearer and better images than they did, you know, even when Michael Brown was killed.
Mm-hmm.
Now the idea that you would whip out your phone and that you would document it is something that, you know, I think particularly among younger generations, you know, you don't even think about it. You just do it.
Right.
And there's an expectation, I think, in the audience that when something major happens, there should be footage of it.
Right.
And so if something happens and there's no footage, then that increases people's doubts, even though that may not indicate anything other than people didn't think to pull out a phone.
Right. And in our last minute and a half or so, I know it's not fair to ask you to do this quickly, but with this 10-year anniversary, what do you think we can expect of media covering 10 years later?
Well, I think a lot of people are going to dig into a lot of the themes that I just talked about earlier, the impact of media and how we expect these viral videos. Also, I think there's going to be a lot of talk about systemic racism and systemic oppression, because one of the things that I think we don't talk about enough is that so many of the social issues that we fight over in America are debates over whether systemic oppression exists in America or not. Mm-hmm. And if it does exist, whether or not it actively harms the people who are oppressed by it. And in particular, when we talk about affirmative action, or when we talk about police brutality, or when we talk about the impact of poverty or disproportionate deaths from COVID, you know, the educational system, how we talk about Black history, all of it is wrapped up in this idea of the question for, and I don't think it is a question. I think it is obvious that we have systemic racism, prejudice, and oppression in America, and certain groups are marginalized by it.
Yes. And we'll
and
have
then
to,
what do you do?
We'll
and
have
then
to,
how do you right. deal with it? Right. And that's what media will be talking about in the wake of this anniversary, I think.
So we'll have to stop there. Eric Deggans is NPR's TV critic and media analyst. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you so much for having me.
This episode was produced by Maya Norfleet and Elaine Cha. Edited by Maya Norfleet. Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.